Hello there, bakeroos and bakerettes. Welcome to the Rise Up podcast. This is Mark Dick. I'm your host, and I'm really glad that you're here. This is the show about bakers and bakeries and bakery owners and all the good things associated with a good loaf of bread or a fine pastry. So I'm glad you're here today. Today on the show, we've got Annie Moss, and Annie is one of the co-owners of Sea Star Bakery and Handsome Pizza in Portland, Oregon. And Sea Star is my friend Rebecca's favorite bakery in all of Portland, which is saying something because that city is known for good food and amazing bakeries. So when I was talking with Rebecca and she said, you know, you got to talk to Annie, this bakery is the best, I had to find out why. And after you hear the conversation with Annie, I think you're going to understand why this is a pretty special place that they've got going. And I can see why it would appeal to Rebecca for sure. And hopefully if you're in the Portland area, it might even appeal to you. So before we get into the conversation, I just wanted to share an email that I got from a fellow named Anthony over the last week. He says, "Hey there, Mark, I wanted to reach out and express my gratitude for your podcast. I've listened to everyone so far and loved every second of it. I've recently started a little cottage food bakery of my own called Loaf Bakehouse, and it's super interesting to hear about everyone's journey in the industry." So thank you, Anthony. That's awesome. I'm really glad that you connected up with me here. The interesting thing, so I'm kind of doing the cottage bakery thing now, and I did it before I opened up my retail place as well. And it's funny that because people start them for a lot of different reasons. And sometimes it's the way to test market. Should I go bigger and open up my own retail shop one day? But I'm finding more and more folks are quite happy with that sort of cottage baking from home, selling at markets kind of a setup. So whichever it is for you, Anthony, I hope that you're enjoying it and you're making the good stuff and sharing it with people. And I hope you keep listening. So thanks a bunch. What else is going on? The baking in my own little backyard cottage shop is going quite well. Summer's coming to a close here at the end of August. And so a lot of my customers that seem to be doing pretty well for themselves and they're out at the lake almost all summer, they're starting to slowly come back now. And thank goodness they're hungry when they come back to the city. So business is picking up. I seem to have been getting an awful lot of gifts lately, which is pretty cool as well, because it's sort of that time of year. So I got a really nice little jug of beer from a local microbrewery from one customer, and some other friends of ours brought us salsa. And in the past, we've gotten bottles of wine. Usually the bottles of wine are when people forget to pick up their bread and then they feel bad. So when they finally come and pick up, they've also got a bottle in their hand. But also, you know, things like jams or plants, or I got a nice three little Ziploc bags of fresh herbs from another friend's garden when she came to pick up her bread. And I actually mean herbs like basil and rosemary and thyme, not air quote herbs, which I will not be receiving until October in Canada. But it's cool, and it got me thinking about I need to be given more gifts myself these days. But when I was out in California last year, spending some time with Craig Ponsford, we'd go to the farmer's market where he would pick up all of his eggs and milk and produce for the bakery. And he always had four or five loaves of bread in the bottom of his little trolley cart to give out to the different vendors when he was picking up produce and dairy. And it's stuck with me, and it's something that I need to do a little bit more of here. I don't, baking on the weekend and buying during the week, I don't seem to have fresh bread to hand out to folks. But at least this last go around the last couple of weeks, I've been baking extra bread and giving it out to folks in need around town when the bake day is done. And so at least, there's a little bit of giving back here. I start to feel a little bit guilty when I'm the one always on the receiving end of things. And I'm learning how to accept gifts, so it's not automatically, well, I now have to give give this the person that gave me the gift something, but I do like to pay it forward to other folks. So, which I guess is a good question. I wonder if I'm sure there's a lot of you out there that are receiving things because people really appreciate the work that you do. I wonder how you pay it forward as well. And that might be a good question. Why don't you drop me an email at mark@riseuppod.com or reach out to me on Instagram at madbaker is my Instagram handle. And let me know. I'm curious to see if how everyone handles that, because it's something that's important to me to make sure that I'm giving back, but sometimes I'm a little awkward in doing it. So that's that. One other thing, I guess, another story to share is that on Saturday, I'm heading off with Cindy and the kids to a wedding, and it's another baker wedding, which is really cool. Heather, who was our first ever employee at Orange Boot Bakery, is getting married to her sweetheart, Coral, on Saturday, and we got invited. And that's great. We haven't seen Heather for a couple of years now, at least. So it was really touching to get the invite to go out to her wedding, because, you know, pretty big day for her. And it made me feel good, because I think when I think it's now four weddings from former bakers that worked at our bakery. Four young women have gotten married over the years and have invited us to their weddings. And that's really nice, because to me anyways, it says, hey, I guess we made a bit of a connection there. And even though we were working really hard and sometimes the days were really stressful, there's still that connection and there's still that bond. And, so it felt really, really nice to get the invitation, and I think we're going to have a really good time. And the other great thing about baker weddings is I know that they're going to pay a bit of attention to food, and so we're probably going to eat well. So hooray. So there's something to be said for that. So yeah, so I'll let you know how that goes, but, should be fun. It's at a little town called McLean, just outside of the city here. So, a little bit rural, probably going to be a little bit outdoors going on. So, that'll be fun. Hopefully the weather holds and, she has a wonderful day. Anyways, enough of that yakking. Let's, get on to the chat I had with Annie Moss of Sea Star Bakery in Portland. So how are you? Thanks so much for doing this.
Yeah, I'm excited to do it. Yeah, thank you.
This is really cool. I think I mentioned, my friend Rebecca said, you know, you got to talk to Annie. This is my favorite place in all of Portland, and that kind of thing. And which is so interesting. Which is like, really, I'm glad she told me, but it's like, wow, Portland is such a food city that I can't even imagine. So what's it like? What's it like owning a place in Portland?
I suppose it has the potential to be like a lot of different things for different people. I think for me, it has been one thing that I love about owning a place, at least the type of place we own, is a very neighborhoody place. I guess there's sort of like, there are restaurants in Portland that are like destination restaurants, you know, people will drive across town to go to them, or tourists come and they all check them out.
Right.
I think that we have our restaurant, there might be like an element of that, but I think more than anything, we have tried to be, and I think pretty successfully, are a neighborhood restaurant.
Awesome.
And that's great. I love that. I mean, I think it's really easy. I imagine this is true in a lot of places. It's pretty easy to get swept up in the kind of, just the how competitive it can be, and
right.
And you know, there's sort of, I guess there is sort of like a rat race quality to being in the restaurant business, and right. You know, watching other restaurants open and close, and lists like there's so many opportunities to be compared to other restaurants, and that part is my very least favorite thing about owning a restaurant.
Right.
And I think the fact that we are more of a neighborhood spot makes it so that we can really focus on the part where we're trying to be a community and getting to know our regulars and being more of a space where people can come and feel like it's an extension of their home rather than so much of a destination, you know? Right.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. No, that makes a lot of sense. It's nice when you can do that. So in my experience, so our city is 200,000 people. So, quite a bit smaller, okay. But, mm-hmm. In a lot of ways it's lost that neighborhood feel. Like we were really mm-hmm. lucky that we had one of the few retail spaces that was in a neighborhood that you could, have people that could walk to the bakery and that kind of thing. And mm-hmm. people came from all over the city because there just wasn't that much out there. It's not like there's 45 different bakeries in town by a long shot.
Yeah.
And still though, the people that walked over or lived right nearby or in the neighborhood were always the ones I like to talk to the most anyways. Right. Cause you could, did you see that construction going on over there? And if that kind of thing, right. Kibitz and talk about stuff. So no, that's the way to do it. If you can pull it off or in my mind, that's what appeals to me anyways. So.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. I mean, I think like we might not be the kind of place that's going to be on all the lists, but we are definitely the kind of place. And this is something we were noticing this last week, that this is the time of year where everybody's coming to visit Portland. And it's so sweet to watch our regular customers come in and bring their parents, bring their friends. Like yes. we have a customer who came through the other day and she wasn't even stopping to get food that day. She just came in and she said, my parents are here visiting and I just wanted them to see where I spend most of my time. And it was so sweet that she felt comfortable enough to just walk in and like introduce her parents to us. You know, that's so yep. sweet.
Yeah. No, I totally relate. That's the best. Yeah.
For yeah.
Sure. For sure. It's because now it's their place as well as mm-hmm. their place. So that's awesome.
Yeah.
So how long have you been open, Annie?
Almost exactly 3 years. Okay. So our restaurant, it's kind of we have sort of a complicated restaurant certain ways. So, there's, one of my business partners who also happens to be my romantic partner, Will, he, owned a pizzeria. He opened a pizzeria about 6 or 7 years ago called Handsome Pizza. Mm-hmm. He bought this little, pizza business called Pizza De Poco's. It was in a converted garage, like a converted mechanic shop, a little just kind of dingy wood fired pizzeria. The rest of the parking lot was food carts. So he bought that and ran it on his own for about 3 years. And towards the end of his time running that, and around the time he and I met, he learned that they were going to redevelop that lot and build, a building there, a mixed use building. So he needed to relocate his business. So when he decided to relocate, he had an employee named Matt. He and Matt agreed that they would be partners on the new, okay. Handsome Pizza 2.0, that's what they called it. And then as they were looking at spaces, they found some spaces they liked, but they were significantly bigger than I think what they felt comfortable with. So then they asked, my friend and business partner, Katya, and I, we were working at Tabor Bread, which is another bakery across town. They asked Katya and I if we wanted to go into business with them. So what ended up coming out of that was for a while, we thought we were going to be two businesses sharing a space.
Right.
So Katya and I kind of developed, C-Star Bakery and, started kind of doing events and branding it. And then as we went through the process of building out the space, we realized that it was just going to be too complicated to keep our businesses separate in a kind of bookkeeping, scheduling, logistics sense. So we ended up deciding to be one business, but we kept the two brands. So now our restaurant, when you walk into it in the morning, we have a menu that's the C-Star Bakery menu. It's wood-fired breakfast, all served on whole grain toast that get, heated up and cooked in the wood-fired oven. And then at around noon, it switches over to be wood-fired pizza. And then my portion of the business, I make all the pastry. And the thing that links all of the components of the business together is that in our breads, in our pastry, in our pizza crust, we're using entirely grains and flours grown in the Northwest and almost entirely whole grains. The pizza crust isn't all whole grain, but most of the other things that we bake are.
Right on. Well, that's really cool because I've heard of a lot of places that do that sort of, well, it's this thing in the morning and it's this thing in the evening. Mm-hmm. But it's, yeah, it kind of makes sense to me. It's like, well, what are you going to, you're going to have two sets of front staff and you're going to have two sets of everything. Like,
yeah.
How do you track it? So did you make that decision after you had opened for a bit, or was it kind of apparent as you were building?
No, it was apparent as we were building. Yeah. I mean, I think once we got into questions of talking about inventory and it really didn't take, I think once we'd kind of gotten through the big hurdles of like finding a space, finding a contractor, figuring out, you know, kind of our budget, once we started to really get into the just like thinking through the day to day, it was pretty apparent that it would be a little too complicated that way.
For sure. For sure. And you're still using a wood fired oven for everything. Is that true?
Well, so we have a convection oven as well. The convection oven, so all the pastries get baked in the convection oven.
Yeah.
The wood fired oven just is never cool enough really for pastry. Yep. And then, so we do bread by subscription only at this point. So we have a sort of a bread share that people sign up for a month at a time. Mm-hmm. They can either, and my business partner, Matt, is kind of the one who is the main overseer of that part of the business. So, people can sign up either for, at this point, we do 2 days a week, Monday and Friday, and they'll sign up for a month at a time. And so once a week for a month, they come in and get a loaf of bread. And those breads can either be done in the wood fired or the convection oven, just depending on the logistics of, I mean, I think at this point we put, so like, because our breakfasts are cooked out of that oven and out of the convection or out of the wood fired oven, and our pizza is cooked out of the wood fired oven, it's getting pretty heavy use all day. So to do bread out of it, it can be a little bit of a puzzle to get the temperatures right. But yep, every now and then, you know, we do try to do it just because it's fun to do, like, you know, a rustic hearth loaf.
Sure. Sure.
From time absolutely to time as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and if you're trying to do your toast work out of the oven, you don't want it plugged up with bread as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, it wouldn't even be, yeah, it wouldn't even be possible.
Yeah. Yeah. So, okay. So I don't normally ask technical questions, but I'm just fascinated. What kind of temperature do you want to run your oven at when you're toasting?
So basically what we ended up, the reason that portion of our menu kind of developed was because we knew we were going to have a live fire in the oven all morning long just to prep it for pizza.
Yeah.
And we kind of just started, I guess, sort of messing around with what we could do with that. So, so we're closed on Tuesday,
yeah,
and Wednesday morning when we come in, that's going to be the coolest that our oven is all week long.
Yeah.
And I think on Wednesday morning, it's probably, I don't know, I'm going to guess it's at like hovering around 400 ish.
Yeah.
Probably not much cooler than that, but maybe right, not much hotter than that. And that's not ideal. Like those are the times. Like if you come in and order breakfast on a Wednesday morning, it's going to take a strangely long time because right, it's just not enough heat to like, I mean, when our oven's really fired up and like later in the week, when there's a lot of heat soaked into it, you can toast a piece of bread in like a couple minutes.
Yeah.
Like it's really fast. You can fry an egg and, you know, you can fry an egg in like 15 seconds. It's really right, a pretty right, fast situation. So, so I think, I mean, we're trying to push it. By the time we turn the oven over to pizza, we want it to be at 650.
Right on.
Or at least 650. And it's usually, I think it's probably working best in the morning when it's at least 500, if not a little.
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. Cause when I asked the question, I forgot, like I had forgotten that, of course, if you're going to be making pizzas in it, you're going to have the live fire going. Cause I've got a brick oven of my own that
yeah,
I so the bread out of, but it's sort of, you know, you uh-huh, fire it the day before and you bake the next day and it's all retained heat.
Yeah.
Kind of thing, but yeah, so yeah,
exactly.
You would
yeah,
really
so go. The whole yeah, it's I mean, and I think that the job of the person who's making breakfast in that oven is a really tough one because you're basically simultaneously trying to keep enough fire in there to get it hot enough for pizza, but you're also standing right there like reaching cast iron pans in and out, and it's a very kind of like brutal yeah, environment.
Yeah, yeah.
It can be.
Yeah, for sure. Plus you're indoors as well. Like I also have the luxury yeah, of having the oven outside, so I'm going to get a breeze no matter what, but I'm not standing there.
You yeah, look
in the oven and you walk away for a while. So yeah, no, that's,
yeah,
that's true. Well, I'm fascinated by the toast and the advanced toast that you had on your website. I laughed so hard when I read advanced toast, and then I started reading the recipes, and I said, "Nah, this is advanced toast. This is some good
stuff." Yeah, yeah,
that's so awesome. The
I have to credit our graphic designer when we were. He was designing our menus for us, and we couldn't think of what to call. We knew that we wanted to serve that type of item, but yeah. We were kind of, you know, there's so many words that just have connotations that we weren't happy with. Like tartine sounds, I mean, one, it's like, you know, now it's been sort of like that word just conjures the actual bakery, but also
as a food, it
just sounds. Yeah. And as a food, it's like, it sounds a little more highbrow than what we're trying to do. And then there's like, you know, I think we just couldn't quite think of anything. So we had, I don't even remember what we had on there, but we had sort of like a placeholder word and sent it to our graphic designer, who's, you know, also a friend of ours. And he came back and had just used that term advanced. I think he read it and was like, "Oh, I'll just call this advanced toast," as still a placeholder. But when we saw it, we were like, that's exactly what it is. Like, we wanted there to be a little bit of humor in it and still be descriptive. And so it ended up that he really nailed it for us.
Yep. Yeah. It's true. It's funny, like how words do that, but it's like, I honestly felt I knew you guys better as soon as I read that page. You know what I mean? Cause because you're doing, you know, good quality stuff, and you talk a lot about the partnerships and the relationships you have with growers and coffee roasters and tea packagers and the whole thing. Right. And then, and you could have decided to go right off the deep end with the wholesomeness of everything. And then you just read that one line and you say, "No, these guys also have a good sense of humor." So I love it.
Thank you.
Yeah. It's so weird. It's funny how, but it struck me just as that. It's like, oh, okay, this is going to be a fun place as well. So that's awesome. So yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that comes through.
Yeah. So, so are you originally from Portland, Danny?
I'm originally from a small town in Oregon called Philomath. It's, it's outside Corvallis, which is where Oregon State University is, but it's about an hour and a half south of Portland.
Oh, okay. All right. And so were you into food and into baking there, or was this something that came later?
Well, I guess kind of some of both. So, growing up, I grew up on a horse farm, and my mom had a great big garden, and I helped her a lot in the garden growing up. And both my parents were really good cooks, and my mom is the kind of cook who's like, I don't know, she's just like a really natural and confident cook. And I have these memories of growing up, and I would go into the kitchen and, you know, hungry, and ask her when dinner would be ready. And her response was, "Well, it'll be ready a lot faster if you help me." So I think I kind of grew up just being pretty comfortable in the kitchen. And, you know, I remember by high school, it was, you know, not a big deal for me to, like, you know, fish up a recipe that I'd never seen before and try it out. And same with baking. I mean, that was just always something that both my parents, my dad, his kind of role in the food part of our family growing up was he cooked breakfast for us every morning. We sat down as a family and ate breakfast. So I think I always had like a pretty strong but easy connection to cooking and food. Sure. And then there was kind of that. And I think I just never felt, I think there is a lot of people have a lot of kind of jittery feelings around baking. I think a lot of people who even like cooking have a lot of jittery feelings around baking. And I just never was exposed to, nobody ever told me there was any reason to feel nervous about it or intimidated by it. So I just didn't. I actually came back into, like, I sort of backed into professional baking in a very unusual way. So when I lived, I went to college in St. Louis, Missouri, and then I moved to New York City after that. And when I was living in New York City, I was really interested in, I had discovered after leaving home that I had this connection to food growing up that I just took for granted. And once I was living in a city and St. Louis at the time was a city that there wasn't much in the way of like a farm to table movement or a sustainable food movement in St. Louis when I was there. I think it's probably different now, but, So I started to notice that, that was lacking in my life, and got, you know, just some education around social justice issues and how that connected with food. And so when I moved to New York, I really wanted to work in that field.
Okay.
So, you know, a couple of different jobs that were related. I was involved in a nonprofit urban farm, and I was involved in sort of some public health advocacy around food access. And then I ended up working for Green Market. So they're the kind of one of the main farmers market coordinators in New York right. City, but they also have a pretty strong, I mean, they're just a pretty, I guess maybe I'm viewing this through Portland standards, but they're pretty big. They have pretty like good capacity. So they were, the first project that I got hired on with Green Market was to help them with a research project around farmland retention in the region. So they were looking at, they'd gotten some funding to look at the needs of farmers in the Northeast through different stages of their career. So beginning farmers, access to land, you know, capital to get things started, mid-career farmers who were trying to maybe grow their operations, or how did they access capital to, you know, take the next step and move their business in a new direction. And then later career farmers around succession planning. So we kind of worked with the farmers who sold at Green Market, did a lot of like interviewing and focus groups, and tried to kind of come up with some recommendations and tools that could help support regional farming in the Northeast. So I was working with the kind of main, well, June Russell, who works at Green Market, she was one of the main people who was kind of overseeing that project. And so I had worked with her. That project was kind of wrapping up. And then she was doing, she had this other project that she needed an assistant on, and she reached out to me. And the other project was their regional grains project. So that, I don't know if you've heard about the Green Market's regional grains project, but yeah. Basically the history of that is, yeah. I'm sure there's a lot more that went on than the simplified version of the story, but the simplified version of the story is, you know, the folks running the Green Markets in New York City are looking around their farmers market, and they're kind of seeing that the, you know, the produce farmers are, and, you know, probably like the meat and dairy farmers as well, they're running these businesses that are very much tied to, you know, tied to regional agriculture, tied to the land, all the kind of like risks that are inherent in that, the kind of stewardship that goes along with that. And then across the aisle, there might be a baker who's using commodity flour and bananas from Ecuador to make banana bread. And so they were really thinking, well, how can we get our bakers to be more in line with our mission?
Right on. Yeah.
Supporting regional agriculture. So the decision that they ended up making was to create a rule that would require all of the bakers selling at Green Market to use, I think it was 15% local in their baked goods. And they simultaneously realized that in order to enforce that rule, they had to make sure there was a market to supply local grains to the bakers.
Yeah,
so right. Green Market sort of just ended up having this, I mean, I still think that the way that this project, and it's ongoing, and I just think that the way that they've gone about it, I really admire it. They took a really kind of like, what seemed like to me to be a very sort of like grassroots, but also like very, very kind of like broad and coordinated approach. I mean, they were working with consumers to get consumers excited about local grains they are as excited about, you know, a local seasonal tomato. And they were working with farmers and trying to get people into the, you know, back into kind of like regional scale milling. And they took on aspects of distribution and marketing. Green Market took on aspects of distribution and marketing. And then also working with bakers to educate them, to connect them with the growers, to kind of, I think a lot about how you can't really support a whole grain baking economy through the structures that support a white flour baking economy. I think they really are different. They're different practices with different mentalities behind them, and sort of they need different structures to support them. And I think Green Market did a really good job of kind of just responding to what came up when they started going down this path. So I was really excited about whole grains. I was really kind of involved in that world, you know, for me, it was definitely like a wake up call. I'd always thought so much about where my produce came from and, you know, dairy and meat. And then suddenly I was like, well, like, I've always just thought of flour as being this sort of like, you know, it's like sort of this like placeless, faceless, you know, just like dead. It had never had that kind of like, image for me, or like that feeling of vibrancy. And so suddenly to be able to discover that it could have that was so exciting to me.
Yeah, for sure. And it's, you're dead on that. It's a journey for everybody in the network, you know, to make that transition. You know, it's something I'm going through myself,
really,
both in terms of education, but also with customers, you know. Yeah, absolutely. The last couple of years I've been doing a lot more, whole grain baking, and a lot, as I learn more about, you know, even like single variety flours and regional flours and, or regional grains, I guess. It's opened up a whole new level of taste, I guess. You know, that's the opportunity, is that, you know, everything tastes different and tastes amazing. And then an entire other level of skill and craft involved to work with these grains. So it's been interesting, even with my tiny customer base, taking them along the journey as well, you know, especially in the early days where it's like, okay, this loaf does not look the way I want, but it tastes great. So please try this, you know, and that kind of thing. But yeah.
Do you feel like your customers are pretty receptive?
It's a growing thing. I think that, you know, the funny thing, there's certain brands, I guess, or certain varieties that they've heard of that get them a lot more excited. So when I bake with Red Fife flour, there's, oh, you're making the Red Fife. Excellent. And I'll get a lot more orders for it. I'm doing some Kamut loaves this week, and they may have heard the name, but there's a lot more education involved with why you might want this, you know? A lot more samples and stuff, but the desire is there, I guess. You know, I've always used organic flour, even though, you know, and local flour, so from grown right nearby, but it, you know, it's been, I'm going to say 3 to 4 times white flour versus whole grain flour. Right. And also, I guess, you know, whole wheat flour, right? Like that's as defined as it got. Yeah. It was either whole wheat or whole rye. And now trying to find, you know, a specific variety of rye or a specific variety of spelt or that, or a specific variety of wheat. There's another miller nearby that is heavy into it. And so I'm buying more and more from her. The miller that I've had the relationship for 10, 12 years now is just like, wheat's wheat, you know, and, Kamut is just sweeter Durum. So put some sugar in your Durum and you're fine. Right. And it's like, oh no, Bob, it's not going to work.
Oh, interesting.
You know, so you're finding, and so when you mentioned changing, like it changes your relationship with millers and stuff. Cause it really does. Cause it's looking more and more like, I'm going to be making a bigger shift towards the second miller, because we're speaking the same language more, which is sad, because I have, like, there's no complaints about the quality of, the grain that I'm getting from both and the flour that I'm getting from both. It's more a case of trying to adjust to the changing times. And because we've got, there's an opportunity with the single variety flowers to get people really excited, and that only helps. You know, it's like that. Yep. It's that. You've probably read that Dan Barber Third Plate book, where he just talks, like he tries to make the case that the fancy chefs, by the fancy chefs doing what they're doing in their restaurants, it eventually trickles down. Right. And it's like, I guess I kind of see it. And I always want it to trickle way, way down. So is that everybody, regardless of income level or ability, has access to the good stuff, and you're not paying top dollar for a loaf of bread, but yeah, I kind of see how it gets to, like, it starts with the very wealthy, and now it's down to my level, and it's got to get down another level, you know, pushing out, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, because my customers are older and are willing to spend an extra dollar a loaf or so for red fife as opposed to whole wheat, right? You know, because it's costing me that. So there we go. Whereas, you know, the folks that can most benefit from it, you know, they're not going to be wanting to pay that kind of money for bread. So
totally,
you know, and it's up to us. So it's up to, and it sounds like you get it. It's up to us to, you know, let's figure out ways to make this more accessible so the prices can come down.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, definitely.
You know, 10 years ago, you couldn't, you know, the price gap between organic and not organic was so huge. And now it's closing up, and now local, well, for me anyways, local is, you pay a huge premium for local anything, because it's not there's not a lot of it here, you know. In Saskatchewan, we just don't have the access that you guys do to the small farmers doing a lot of different varieties, you know.
Right,
but it's a start. Yeah, well, that's I had no idea about your green market experience. That is really neat.
And that's what kind of got me into it. So I moved back to Portland. I had a great time living in New York and knew that it wasn't a place that I wanted to live I lived there for 4 years and was ready to be done. And so I'd always wanted to live in Portland. Growing up, I thought it was just like the best city.
Right.
So when I moved here, I kind of figured, I mean, my assumption was that local grains is too kind of niche. And when I do my job search, I have to like broaden it and go back to kind of a broader sort of food systems view of what's out there for work. And I happened to come across this job posting when I was searching. I'd already moved back to Portland, and I happened to come across this job post for a bakery that was going to be opening. It hadn't opened yet. It would be opening in a few months in Southeast Portland. And they were going to be the first bakery in Portland to source all of their whole grains locally and mill them all in house.
Wow.
And to focus entirely on whole grain wood fired bread. So they were advertising for a pastry chef. And so I responded to this job post, and I said, you know, I kind of gave them this like overview of my background, and I said, I'm not a pastry chef and I'm not going to pretend to be one, but I just think you should know that I exist because I have this interest and it's really in line with what you're doing. Mm-hmm. And they reached out to me and ended up, so the bakery is called Tabor Bread, and Tissa Stein, who's the owner of Tabor Bread, reached out to me, and she ended up bringing me on as her general manager. I'd had a little bit of experience in New York managing a bakery called the City Bakery. I mean, I spent a short amount of time kind of managing front of house stuff at the City Bakery. So it was, and I'd run a nonprofit. So I had like enough, it was sort of a fake it till you make it situation, but I felt okay about my skill set in terms of just being in charge.
Yeah.
And then, you know, really, I mean, had so much to learn about being a good leader and a good manager, and I'm still learning those lessons. But anyway, so that was sort of a foot in the door out here. And so I started out at Tabor Bread managing and, you know, really did kind of everything. And along the way was trained by the pastry chef and the bread bakers to be able to help out. You know, the pastry chef just needed assistance from time to time. So she would kind of teach me a task and I would be able to help her with that. And I would watch what she did and I would ask her lots of questions. And then the bread bakers, I was trained to do the mixing and shaping of the bread so that I could fill in shifts from time to time. So I got more and more into the kind of like hands-on aspect of it. And towards the end of my time at Tabor Bread, the pastry chef who had been kind of the pastry chef who had started there and been running the pastry program for several years kind of left, and we hadn't found a replacement yet. So I sort of just like found myself suddenly doing the pastry there.
There you go.
It was terrifying. And and so then by the time we opened our restaurant, which wasn't a super long time after that, by the time we opened our restaurant, I knew enough about just the system. So what's kind of similar with Tabor Bread's pastry program and our pastry program is we're focused on just the retail pastry. So it's not a huge production.
Right. Yeah.
We're not doing wholesale. We in Hanson Pizza and Sea Star Bakery, we've been very intentional about, you know, I think bakeries kind of have a couple choices. Like you can either go for volume and try to make your money that way. Or for us, we went more for, you know, trying to supplement the baking with the cafe component. So, having more prepared food, the pizzas are really helpful. Like we really were very conscientious of not wanting to spread ourselves too far, like not get into like having to deliver, having to do farmers markets. I think those are all great, valid, ways to make your business run, but it just wasn't what we wanted to do. So I had enough experience doing that style of a pastry program to know how to structure it. And then, you know, we just opened and I've been, you know, just sort of tripping myself up and then picking myself up and dusting myself off again and again and again as I learn how to make better pastry.
Yep.
You know, you just have to make all the mistakes. And it's the same with, the two kind of main roles, well, I do a lot. I kind of do a little bit of everything at the restaurant. I'm the main, you know, the pastry program is my department, but then I do a lot of front of house and front of house kind of training and staffing. I love the retail aspect of this work because I think especially when you're trying to push into kind of unfamiliar territory like whole grains, it's a pretty exciting process of trying to bring people, like you said, bring people along with you.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, just managing. I mean, that's like learning how to be a good manager. That's the other big, big part of it for me.
Wow.
Yeah.
Man, so that's... Yeah, that's so cool. I have a question that's been sticking in my head. When you were in St.
Yeah.
What was your degree?
Oh yeah. So in when I was an undergrad, I had a major in Spanish literature. I'd lived abroad in Argentina for a year. So was just, you know, loved speaking Spanish and wanted to keep speaking Spanish. So it kind of just ended up getting, you know, just being able to get that degree just from wanting to take continuous Spanish courses. But then my minor, which the more I think back and reflect on it, I'm like, oh, this is really relevant. I minored in sculpture.
Okay.
As a pastry chef, I feel like it's totally irrelevant.
Sure. Sure. Well, okay. I mean, yeah. So this is
the same. It's just edible sculpture.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, this is so wild to me because having done, so what's really interesting with the story you just told me is that, you know, having done the work in New York around nonprofits and social justice and you know, regional economies and that kind of thing. And so you come back to Portland where from my romanticized view of the Pacific Northwest anyways, is, you know, the hotbed for the exact same kind of thing. You've got, you know, the bread lab and you've got, you know, all the local stuff. And so what was the drive for you to actually open up a bakery restaurant as opposed to being the linchpin in this, you know, in building out the regional economy, if you will?
Yeah.
You know, because it seems like you could have gone in two directions here, you know?
Yes.
Neither would have surprised me.
Yeah. Well, I have to say, I want to say I really appreciate that question. I feel like that's a really thoughtful question. I feel still like I guess one very simple answer is that I don't think that the decision that I made to open a restaurant means that that's going to be what I do forever. And I think there's always going to be opportunity to do the other thing. I think, I mean, a very like kind of just logistical answer was that was the job that was available. There wasn't really anybody at the time when I moved here in 2012, there wasn't as much institutional support in the Northwest at that time, I don't think, for the regional grain stuff that's happening. I think more institutional support has crept up since then. I think in a way, like having a restaurant has given me more legitimacy in the work.
Yeah, I can see that.
It's like, given me a different...
Your hands are dirty. Kind of,
yeah,
for sure. Yeah, yeah.
And then I think, I mean, you know, I've been able to, I still have that in me. I think that's why I like that question, because I recognize myself by there is a part of me that's still kind of like, but I want to be, you know, sort of coordinating the bigger picture. Like that, that is just sort of what I like. I mean, I like doing that in our restaurant. I like sort of coordinating the big picture of our restaurant, but also just being able to go out and feel like I'm connecting people and making this, you know, making things happen. I like that kind of work. So, I mean, one thing that I've been able to do in my capacity owning this restaurant is I've been able to teach classes. So teaching whole grain baking classes in a variety of different venues, participating in conferences. I think trying to really, I mean, I do think that having a restaurant, what I love about it is that, I mean, I think the drive behind a lot of people who are involved in nonprofit work, right, is that you're trying to make the world a better place. That sounds very simplistic, but I think that really is simply is what a lot of people are trying to do. And I think what I love about owning a restaurant is that we've created, Matt and Will and Katya and I, my four business partners, we've created this little microcosm of a world that we can try to make reflect what we wish the bigger world was like.
Right on.
We're not always great at it, and we are constantly like learning how to do better at it. And I, you know, I think we'll never be perfect at it, but it, at least it's kind of empowering to have a little space that you can influence in that way.
Yeah.
So I've been really satisfied by that, but I still think, I mean, I dream about, you know, when we don't have this restaurant anymore, I still dream about kind of what are other gaps I see? What are other ways that, this movement could be supported? I mean, I think capitalism is a broken system, but I think ways being a small business owner is, satisfies me more than I think working in the nonprofit sector would.
Gotcha. Yeah. No, that's cool.
They're both products of capitalism anyway. So yeah, I think it's a good question and one that I'm always trying to kind of, I think I'm always trying to fit the pieces together to still be participating in what you're describing.
Well, there's a, one of my heroes is a fellow named Seth Godin, and he talks about entrepreneurship in terms of, you know, you've now got your own little piece of land here that you're going to build a house on, and you get to build it however you want. Right. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the four of you going into business together, you get to build it however you want. Right. And you can focus on margins and how much are you going to take, or you can focus on the community, that you're building and the relationships that you're making and you know, everything's valid as long as you're clear with yourself, true to yourself about what you're doing it for. And it sounds like, you the way you're building C-Star and Handsome Pizza is intentional. And it's very much what we want to do. This is the role that we want to play in the community. And this is how we want to bring good food to people. And this, you know, the whole thing. And so that's awesome. You know, well, and the fact that you've got three other partners to work with as well, right? Like,
I mean, I was going to say that's sort of, we created what I think is simultaneously the hardest part of our business and also the best part of our business in deciding to have four owners. I mean, it's not a very big business, so it's, you know, it's four of us sharing not a huge amount of, you know, space, but it, I think it's been a really good atmosphere for each of us to kind of, you know, just think about how we are in the world and think about how our actions influence other people and to learn how to make compromises in a real and stressful environment. I can totally see how it'd be so much easier to just do exactly what I want on my own. I also like really can't imagine having having learned all of the lessons that I've learned without, you know, these three other people who there to kind of help me and make me feel like, you know, it's just nice to have people who will accept you and are sort of committed enough. I mean, it's in some ways it's like a marriage, right? Like you can kind of feel safe to mess up sometimes because you know that person isn't just going to decide, well, I can just quit and just leave. Like it's a little more complicated than that.
Yeah, for sure. But on the other hand, it's also a marriage conducted in public, you know, like all the time too. Right. So you've got
Yes. Oh my God. You're telling me, oh my God.
It's like if,
oh my God. Yeah. I mean, I actually am like,
It's like if one partner's going off one way and you're going off in another way, your customers are going to be left scratching their heads. Right. So do you guys take,
and our staff?
No, oh, yeah. Gee whiz. Yeah. Oh.
Do we?
Sorry. Oh no, sorry. You floored me there. I got a bunch of bad memories coming back with our, I don't think I mentioned, like, my wife and I ran a retail bakery for 5 years before we eventually sold that and then did this, and it was excellent, and we learned a lot about each other in that. But the Mark wants to do it this way and Cindy wants to do it that way didn't come up very much, but it was very, very clear how we could really mess with the staff by doing that, right? And you know, we used to always joke that our executive meetings were the 5-minute drive home from the bakery home at the end of the day, and you know,
oh my God.
We'd thrash it out. You know, we'd have till the 4-way stop to thrash out the problem, and then from the 4-way stop to home to decide on the solution, kind of a thing. And that was how,
yeah,
thank God we got it out of there. But there were days that we'd come home and say, boy, you know, we really messed with Patty the baker today. with I wanted to do it one,
yeah,
she wanted to do it the other. So yeah, so I can see the need for communication on even like the big picture, you know, why are we doing this and what are we trying to get out of it? With four individuals, you know.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
But then when it works, my goodness, like how awesome is that to have the support of the other partners?
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Well, no,
and
that's
how it's also great when you're just, you know, sometimes you're just exhausted and exasperated, and to have three other people be like, still, you know, still have their heads in the game when you're having this moment of being like, I just can't have my head in the game right now.
Yeah.
It's a huge relief.
For sure. Oh, that, yeah. That sounds really positive, I have to say. So the neighborhood that you're in, can you tell me a bit about that, Annie? Like, what's sort of who are your people, and where are you in Portland? I don't know the city very well at all.
Yeah. So, okay. Yeah. All right. So we are located in Northeast Portland.
Okay.
I think what is notable about North and Northeast Portland to maybe somebody, who hasn't been to Portland, or when you're new to Portland, North and Northeast Portland were more historically more the kind of African American section of the city.
Okay.
And you know, as is happening in a lot of places, it's been pretty gentrified. And I think a lot of the growth, you know, Portland, I think this probably isn't a surprise to you, but Portland has experienced a ton of growth in the last decade. Right. And a lot of that growth has transformed North and Northeast Portland. So we're the strip that we're on of businesses, when we opened our restaurant, it was a building that's been around for a while, but had recently been kind of remodeled and reopened. And so there was five retail spaces in the building, and we were the second one to build out and open our doors.
Okay.
Maybe no, we were the third one. So it's, you can imagine it was like a very, the neighborhood was super excited to see stuff going in there because it had been this corner that, you know, people felt unsafe about. It just had sort of this lousy reputation. And since we've opened, now there's new buildings going up across the street. There's a marijuana store across, you know, on the corner that also just opened up. And so there's like a lot more. I mean, even just in the 3 years since we've opened, it's, the block has really transformed.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So it's, and the, I would say the families that live up in North and Northeast Portland, it's probably an area that was stayed affordable longer than a lot of other parts of Portland that are maybe more established. So I feel like it tends toward, it definitely tends towards like younger, single people, couples, young families,
right.
More so than like, there's areas of the town that's definitely like, you look in those houses and you just like imagine it's just like full of high school, or, you know, like parents and all their high school kids and all their friends. I think of where we are, it's like 2-year-olds. We have a lot of our customers have like very small children, which is really sweet.
It can still be sort of like the first house purchase.
Oh, yeah.
Neighborhood.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
I mean, I think that's probably changing even that. I mean, it's just becoming like Portland is becoming like not as affordable of a place, right, or has already become that. So I do think that's changing, but I think that there are plenty of people who live in the neighborhood who are probably, yeah, it probably is like their first house. Right. Yeah. And it's, you know, now it's been, it's been pretty thoroughly gentrified. So it's not as diverse as, it probably once was.
Right.
I think that's like a pretty common Portland story. And then, yeah. And I guess the other notable thing about it is that we're on Killingsworth Street, which is kind of, one main street up to the north from, Alberta Street, which is a really pretty major like retail and kind of, shopping and restaurant area. So we're kind of we're sort of on the outskirts, just on the outer edge of like some pretty major areas, like draws for people.
Gotcha.
Like good food. And we're, you know, on our block, there's other really good restaurants. I mean, I think we've ended up in kind of a sweet area, but when 3 years ago when we moved here, there was a lot less going on.
Sure.
For sure.
Sure. Cool. No, that's neat. I've only been to Portland once and it was last year, and I came in from the south.
Okay.
And then I have to say between the bridges and the river and all that, I don't know what direction I came out.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I think that's reasonable.
I know I went to Little T because,
because
he's a Bread Baker's Guild member like I am. So I said, well, that was the one I knew about.
And, yeah.
But then I was literally on my way through town. And so I didn't stop anywhere else. And then, last week when I was checking out your website and stuff, I saw a link to a fundraiser that you did with 25 other bakeries where you each contributed a cookie for like this cookie.
Oh yeah, box. That was so cool.
And yeah. And I'm like, 25 other bakeries that would be cool enough to contribute a cookie. I said, oh my God, why didn't I stay here 3 weeks? But
Portland has a great, I think that's such a hard thing about traveling though. When like, you go to a new city, I feel like Will and I always experience this. We go to a new city that we're, you know, just visiting, and you know, I don't really trust Yelp. I don't really know if I trust TripAdvisor. And I'm like, where do the people who live here go? And I just want to know where the people who live, you know, it's so hard when you're in a new place if you don't know people there.
Yeah. Yep. But there's an outside chance that I'm coming out to see Rebecca in early October.
Oh, nice.
When she does the big launch for her company.
Oh, and, cool. How do you and Rebecca know each other?
Oh, well, we took a course together called, we both coached in this thing called the Alt MBA.
I've heard of the Alt MBA.
Yeah. Yeah. And we were coaches in that together. And then we got along so well that we stay in touch a lot. And she gave me, or she asked me to help her as much as I can from Saskatchewan with her Prosper City startup. So I've been trying to help her with that, with some of the strategy and stuff. Because I can't go door to door from here trying to drum up businesses in Portland.
Yeah.
But I help as much as I can from a distance. But yeah, she's one of the most amazing people I've ever met. So it's sort of like I say, when she says, can you do this? It's like, yes, what is it? It's like that's sort of the thing. If she asks for help, I say yes. And then I ask what it is, because that kind of person.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, but it's neat about the neighborhood. And are you, are you able to do things with the restaurant sort of in the community, if you will? Like, is it that kind of neighborhood that you've got stuff going on that you can sort of be a part of?
Yes, I think so. I mean, we definitely try to. I think we try to be available. Well, so one thing that's actually kind of like a pretty simple, but I think a really meaningful connection that we make is that we, on our pizza menu, so the way that Will designed the pizza menu when he first started Hanson Pizza was he named pizzas after Portlanders that he admired or thought were cool. So it could be a friend of, it could be a friend of his, or it could be, Will's a big comic book nerd, so it could be a local comics artist. And then, so on our permanent menu, we sort of have, like, you know, the permanent menu is named after people, but then we always have, we run specials, and those will kind of rotate to be named after different people. And again, it could just be that, like, one of us has a friend that we want to name a pizza after, but oftentimes, and it seems like it's kind of morphing more and more into this direction, that we'll name a pizza after somebody who's doing a project that we want to support, or a nonprofit that, you know, we want to draw attention to. So that's one way that, to just kind of, like, link what we're doing to the outside world. I think just, I think like, we get, as a, I don't know if this was your experience as well when you had a retail bakery, but we get a lot of requests for donations and
Stuff
like that.
Yeah.
So just trying to, like, you know, I think when we sort through those requests, the thing that's sort of at the top of our list of priorities is either supporting things in the neighborhood or supporting things that are, you know, just have a mission that we are, is part of kind of our ethic.
I gotcha. Yep. No, absolutely.
And then, so I think there've been things where we, like, we'll, like, send, you know, cookies to an event, or try to send, you know, send pizzas to a fundraiser or something like that. Our space isn't huge. So I've, you know, every now and then we have dreams of, like, dreams of events that we think would be really cool to do in a space, but it's, in some ways it's not an ideal space for bigger events.
I hear you.
Smaller gatherings we can support, and we try to do that as well.
Oh, groovy. No, that's really neat. The reason I asked is just about, you know, again, that idea of the neighborhood shop and the ties to the community and that, right? And
I would also say, like sort of our staff lives in the neighborhood, which is also really cool.
That's excellent. Yeah. I know with us, I was, same kind of a thing. You always get a ton of donation requests, but for us, the ones that we automatically said yes to were the ones from sort of the long-term customers that we had that were active in the community. Right. So, you know, if Susan came with something for, she was the local Grandmothers for Grandmothers chapter. It's what do you need? Right. You know?
Yeah.
And then some, you know, or the, you know, seniors learning or the AIDS program or whatever. It's like, absolutely, you know, but it was like, you know, they're sort of like, what we weren't able to do. And it was mainly because the community never had it is, you know, I still wish that, the folks in the neighborhood had put together a bit of a block party, because it would have been fun to, you know, for a day, set up a tent and just go and have some fun with folks. And we never got around to starting it ourselves. So, you know, I was talking with a friend of mine in Minnesota that, when they turned 3 years old, he did a block party as part of that. And it was like, good for you that you got the space and the time to do that. That was something we never did, you know, I was always hoping for, is there something that someone else wants to put on for their anniversary, if you will?
Right. piggyback?
I don't want it to be about me so much as, you know, about the neighborhood, you know?
Yes.
Yeah.
And I think I appreciate you bringing that up.
Yeah.
Because I think something that we are always kind of, you know, just aware of and kind of paying attention to in our business is that, I think it's important. It feels really important for us to do, you know, to be a part of our community and to try to kind of, like, recognize the privilege that we have as, you know, for, you know, white educated people with pretty solid backgrounds to be able to open this restaurant and kind of pursue our dreams. And so, you know, trying to be aware of that and trying to, like, act in a way that is responsive to that and not having that be entangled with, marketing. Like, I think that's I think we all feel sort of, and I think this is also partially just the four of us happen to have like the way that our personalities work, we're sort of, I think we're all just like a little bit more comfortable kind of keeping things on the, like, quiet a little bit. But so I think it's like, we just don't want to feel like the reason we're doing this is because we want people to think that we're great and they want to come to our business. We want people to come to our business because we make good food. We make them feel good. Like they feel like we're their people, but we also want to do these other things. And yeah, it's just kind of a weird territory, I think, when you're in a business.
No, I hear you for sure. Cause the requests come fast and furious from the first day you open.
Yes. It's amazing.
Yeah.
It's really amazing. Actually.
Really amazing. Yes. Sure. And so it's nice to have, again, it's all about having a good intention, you know,
and
the right intention going forward. Yeah. Yeah. It's, I even forget the scenario now, but I remember somebody coming into the shop about something we had done and said, boy, is that ever great marketing that you
right.
did. And I felt a little crushed. No. let's talk about the cause here. It
was not, yeah.
Yeah. No, I got you 100%. Yeah, no, cool. So you're year three heading into year four. What are you working on or struggling with these days? What's the big challenge?
That's a great question. Well, okay. What's the big challenge? I think one thing that's been a challenge is that we all, so my main department is pastry. Katya right. oversees kind of the savory wood-fired breakfast menu. Will and Matt kind of share pizza, but Will maybe is, Will's more singularly focused on pizza, and Matt also works on the bread. And I think one thing we're all kind of messing around with is, as we're trying to find our balance between, you know, part of the reason we opened a business with four people was because we didn't want to kill ourselves and we didn't want our whole entire lives to be running this business. And so I think there's a challenge in just how do you structure your department in a way that you can share ownership with staff and not feel like you have to be there all the time, but still feel, it's weird. Like I feel of two minds about it. I love baking. I mean, I bake at home all the time when I'm not baking at work. Like there's something to me so miraculous about the fact that I do this thing professionally that I still want to do when I come home on the weekend. And so part of me feels like a lot of sadness about handing over, you know, some of my days. I've handed over some of the days that I do pastry to other staff and put myself in a position of, you know, being a dishwasher for that day, just because I think it's better for our staff if they can feel that ownership and feel that continuity. So that's one, I think that's one kind of challenge, that we're kind of working through right now is just figuring out how we, keep ourselves in it and also give ourselves space to not be in it. And then I think the other thing that we're always looking at is the balance between, making sure that the four of us as owners are taken care of, but always wanting to try to kind of give more to our employees. I think it's very important to me that people see food service work as being a dignified profession. I think that it's very, the culture around, you know, jobs and our economy really doesn't support the view of food service work as being a dignified profession, unless you're kind of maybe like an upper echelon chef
right.
person.
Yep.
So I, you know, we like the ways that we can influence that just by, you know, making sure our staff feels like they're not just cogs in a machine. We're respectful of their, you know, outside circumstances, their outside goals, giving them, you know, we've started providing, a health insurance program that they can be a part of, trying to make sure that we're, you know, compensating them as best as we possibly can. I think this is probably true of all restaurants. Like you're doing your best in a system that is a little bit broken or a lot broken. Yeah.
It's a lot broken. Yep.
Yeah. So that's, I mean, that's just like an ongoing challenge for us.
That's awesome though. It's awesome that you've got that top of mind. Cause I've talked with a lot of folks, you know, through the podcast about, just that food service is broken. It's so, there are just so many cases of it's really done on the backs of folks that aren't very well. aren't given near enough hours. Like, it's how do you ever make rent? You know, that
kind of thing. Or expected to you know, work all the time, or expected to be told, you know, 3 days in advance, well, you're going to be working tomorrow. You know, you're going to be working this week. Yeah. You know, I just think like,
People
need to have some agency.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, and how, you know, your top person can be working 80 hours a week at Christmas time and get no hours in February just because of all the flow. And it's like, well, what's up with that? How, you know, and that's, how, you know, how it happens in so many places, and so good for you. And even the part about, you know, handing off duties and that, like I've talked with a lot of folks that it's like, that's so important for the staff as well. Like a growth, like that sort of career path. How can this be a career job? How can, you know, how can people progress? You know, there's folks that I've talked with, I don't know if it's been on the show or just one-on-one where, you know, the reason we expanded was because we had senior staff and, didn't want to lose them. So it's like, well, let's do this new thing.
That's right? So interesting.
You know, like that kind of a thing. Say, well,
so yeah,
that drove the company's growth because we didn't want to lose these senior people, and they were going to get bored eventually. So, you know, and so now your partnership of four maybe becomes six or something, formally or informally or what have you. So I haven't talked to a million people in this, but it's that seems to be a really nice place to be in year four. The people that I have talked about or talked to that are sort of, we're wrapping up 3 years, we're kind of working on year four, it tends to get to that, you know, we've got this thing going now, and it starts looking back at the staff a little bit and looking back at the whole picture about how do we make this thing run so it's good for everybody. So
that's
awesome. So I'm really happy for you in that regard.
Thank you.
You know, like I say, it's you know, based on a dozen data points at least, but that's all it is, but it seems you're in a really good spot. So
that's great.
Yeah. Cool. Well, is there anything that I didn't ask you that you wished I did?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't think so. I mean, I did want to tell you that actually when I was listening to some of your episodes when I've been doing the pastry bake off the last couple mornings while I'm at work on my own. And there was the most recent one where there was a guest that you anticipated coming and didn't end up coming.
Right.
And I actually loved that episode. I really loved hearing you talk. I think I just was really appreciative of your, it seems like you just have a very inclusive mindset around your kind of view of baking in the baking world. And I think that there's a lot of it's very easy, I think, in the baking world to kind of get into sort of a purist mindset about this is the right way. This is the most valid, you know, this is kind of what I'm striving for. And I just really appreciated your perspective on that, because it sounded like you were really, you know, just able to find the value in so many different approaches. So I just wanted to tell you that I really loved hearing your musings.
That's so great. It's funny because, I think we're 20 episodes in, and there's been two that I've had to go, solo on because I didn't have the interviews queued up in time. And I started the podcast because, when I had the bakery before, after, I've just been fascinated by the stories of different bakers. And I just think bakers in general are some of the very most generous people that I've ever met. And so I wanted to share that with people. And I get such good feedback on the solo ones too. So, thank you. That warms my heart.
Good. Well, thank you. Yeah. It is really fun to hear. I mean, I think, the other thing with baking is you can get really trapped in your little world, and it's hard to go out and meet people. So it is really fun to have a place to go and listen to what other people are doing.
Yeah. Well, and you know, with that style episode there, it's just so true. It's like, like I said earlier, I'm fascinated by this shift towards whole grains and the flavor opportunities and that you can do that, how you can make the bread taste different, and not, you're not adding cheese to make it taste different, or you're not adding herbs, you know, that's just with the grain itself. I think that's fascinating. And yet you're never going to hear me complain about a French baguette that's all flour. Like, it's delicious. So, yeah. You know, so, and that's, you know, I used to have there was a woman would come into the bakery and was always giving me the business about that we weren't 100% organic, like, our, you know, and it's like, well, I'm making a garlic sourdough where the flour is all local and organic, but the garlic isn't. And she's like, well, I'm not buying this. And it's like, I'm sorry, man. Cause you know, like, I can't get local garlic year round. And even if I did, you know, like, what's stuff that's been, you know, it's
yeah,
there, you can't please everyone, but you
try, definitely not.
But you know, I don't know. As time goes on, I'm more open to going down my own, paths of things that interest me. And it's just, it's varied. And so, yeah. So, you know, I still have yeast and I still have white flour and I'd like to use more whole grains, and I will use more whole grains, but I'm not gonna just go cold turkey yet. So, oh, well.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, thank you. Well, thank you so much. And, this has been an absolute thrill, and I'm dying to come down and visit you face to face here, and especially try the advanced toast. That's
really, like, good.
My gosh. Like, that's great. Well, and maybe a couple of pieces.
That sounds great. Yeah. Well, hopefully maybe we'll see you in October.
Yeah. So I appreciate the time, Annie, for sure. And I just wish you guys huge success.
Thank you.
And best of luck in the future for sure.
Thanks. You too. Thank you so much.
Yeah, you bet.
All right. Have a good one.
And that was Annie. Really cool talk. I did not know all of that background about the time she spent at Green Market in New York City and how she brought that mindset back to Portland and back to her bakery, which is really cool. That's, I think, why I like having these chats, is because you find out there's a lot of depth to people that are bakers and bakery owners. And they've got a lot of experience that they bring and a lot of feeling that they bring to their work. So thank you, Annie, for the great conversation. And I hope if you're in the Portland area, you go and check out her place, C-Star Bakery. So that's it for this week. If this is the first time listening, check out all the rest of the episodes. This is episode 22. So there's more to hear at riseuppod.com. That's riseuppod, all one word, .com. And until next week, have a great week and happy baking.